Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today you'll hear two reruns of sorts, a couple highlights from the latter half of 2020 as we gear up for next year. In the first interview, you'll hear from John Lieber, Managing Director of Eurasia Group, who joined the show to discuss the process and implications of policymaking in a divided government. In the following interview, you'll hear from Republican U.S. Senator from Louisiana, Bill Cassidy, and Democratic U.S. Senator from New Hampshire, Maggie Hassan, who joined the show to discuss the bipartisan proposal on COVID-19 relief they helped negotiate and co-author, which also served as the baseline in negotiations for the eventual relief package that was just signed into law. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. A variety of news sources are reporting that President Trump signed into law a major coronavirus relief package along with an annual spending bill, avoiding a government shutdown before a Monday night deadline. The president has railed against the $900 billion coronavirus relief bill and a $1.4 trillion government funding bill since Congress approved it, demanding $2,000 checks and cutting out foreign aid. But on Sunday evening, after days of being lobbied by allies, he decided to sign the bill. Without action, the government was set to shut down on Monday night after a temporary spending law expired. Though the president's decision headed that off, his initial refusal to sign the bill may still have consequences after unemployment benefits lapsed over the weekend. With the president's signature, federal unemployment benefits that lapse December 26th can start to flow again. Jobless aid recipients will get an extra $300 per week on top of regular benefits for 11 weeks. A federal eviction moratorium for renters behind on their payments, which had been set to expire New Year's Day, is now extended for another month, and at-risk renters will receive $25 billion in financial assistance. The president's signature came with a catch, however. He said he'd send a, quote, redlined version back to Capitol Hill, along with a formal request for lawmakers to rescind or cancel spending items he finds objectionable. Under a process outlined in the 1974 law establishing the modern budget process, a rescission's message puts a 45-day hold on the targeted funds while Congress weighs legislation to approve the president's request. If lawmakers don't act, the funds must be released. The House voted 322-87 on Monday to override President Trump's pre-Christmas veto of the fiscal year 2021 defense authorization bill. The Senate is expected to hold its own override vote this week. The massive $731.6 billion legislation, known as the National Defense Authorization Act, includes provisions for military pay raises, the construction of military housing, and sweeping improvements to the federal government's approach to cybersecurity, among thousands of others. Should the Senate vote be delayed by procedural moves, the chamber will have until the next Congress begins at noon January 3rd to hold the vote. If senators miss that deadline, the legislation expires and the veto stands. The president apparently took issue with a provision in the bill to rename military bases that honor Confederate figures and the lack of a provision that would repeal legal protections for social media companies found in Section 230 of a 1996 communications law. The president has also balked at language that would impose limits on how many troops can be withdrawn from Afghanistan and Germany and how quickly. But the NDAA conference report passed both chambers of Congress with veto-proof majorities and enjoys wide-ranging bipartisan support. However, apparently Senator Bernie Sanders will filibuster an override of the president's veto unless the Senate holds a vote on providing $2,000 direct payments to Americans as additional COVID-19 relief. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has yet to address the timing of such a vote. Under Senate rules, Sanders has the ability to keep the chamber in during the holiday. and likely interfere with the campaign schedules of Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, who face a January 5th runoff race for control of the Senate against Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, who are both campaigning on the $2,000 checks. Sanders also threatened to shut down the government earlier this month if the coronavirus relief bill did not include direct payments. Ultimately, it included checks of up to $600. The House passed the payment boost sought by the president and Democratic leaders on Monday evening, and the president said the Senate has agreed to, quote, start the process on a stimulus checks vote when he signed the $900 billion relief bill. The 275 to 134 vote came with 44 Republicans joining nearly all Democrats to back the increase. The vote sends the measure to the Senate, where it seems unlikely Republicans controlling that chamber will put the bill backed by the president on the floor in a form that it can pass. The House bill increasing the size of the tax rebate checks to $2,000 per adult as well as each dependent will cost almost $464 billion, according to the Joint Committee on Taxation. That's more than half the entire COVID-19 aid measure the president just signed. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman, and John Lieber, Managing Director at Eurasia Group, will discuss the process and implications of policymaking in a divided government, which could be a reality for the incoming Biden administration depending on the results of the upcoming Georgia runoff elections. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by John Lieber, Bob Bixby, and Tori Gorman. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tori is Concord's Policy Director, and both are regular contributors on the show. John is Managing Director at Eurasia Group, where he leads coverage of political and policy developments in Washington. He has extensive experience in government, including as an economist at the House Ways and Means Committee, a director at the National Economic Council at the White House, and a senior economic policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. John has also worked as an economist at a San Francisco-based startup and researched monetary policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome to the show, John, Bob, and Tori.
Thank you, Chase.
Pleasure to have you all here. And I'm actually going to pivot right out the gate to Tori because she has a couple excellent questions. So I'm going to yield the floor to her. So take it away, Tori.
So, John, right out of the gate, obviously, we don't know who controls the Senate at this point in time. We've still got two runoff elections in Georgia yet to happen. But even if the Democrats do win the two runoffs in Georgia, they're not going to have a supermajority. They might have the majority, but they're not going to have a supermajority in the Senate. But it still means that Schumer presumably would be the majority leader and would be able to control the agenda setting in the Senate and be able to control the floor and have things like right of first recognition. So even though the Democrats may not have a supermajority, and of course the Republicans won't have a supermajority, how important is it strategically to be able to control the agenda in a divided government in the Senate?
I mean, it's the entire game. I think it's the whole, I think controlling the Senate is really key to Biden, whatever Biden's going to accomplish next year. And if they don't have the Senate, it's going to be hard for him to, you know, confirm an assistant dog catcher. So I think that they really need to, you know, if they have 50 votes, they can still pass budget bills through reconciliation. They can confirm most of Biden's cabinet appointees without breaking a sweat. Biden can do what he set out to do. What they can't do are some of the broader regulatory things, like they can't raise the minimum wage. They'd have a hard time, you know, adding DC as a state. There's a couple of, you know, there's non-budgetary things that I think would be priorities for the Democrats if they had, you know, 53, 54, 55 seats. They just aren't going to be able to accomplish with 50 or 51 seats. And 50 is probably the best case scenario for them right now.
Right. The options in the Senate for next year vary anywhere from between 52-48 with Republicans in control and 50-50 with the Democrats in control. We were talking about just about agenda setting and policy setting and how the majority affects that. But it also affects smaller things, right? Like things like committee ratios and committee budgets and the policy machinations that happen at the committee level as well. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the Republicans stay in control of committee, Republicans stay in the majority. They have all the chairmanships, they have all the gavels, they have more staff, they've got the bigger budgets. And that's helpful for them. But the committees have been pretty quiet the last 4 years under Trump. You get some bills moving, you don't get budgets, so that's off the table, and that's probably going to continue to be off the table. You get some bills moving, like in the Commerce Committee, there was a highway bill that they put out there, and then you get things out of the Appropriations Committee, And that probably doesn't look that different depending on who controls the gavel. But you know, if the Democrats get 50-50, then you've got to negotiate all that stuff. You've got to negotiate who's going to be in charge, what the budgets are going to be, what the ratios are, and all those things. And a 50-50 Senate is a really, really challenging way to govern. So I think that even the Democrats' best case scenario right now, you're looking at a pretty limited agenda for Biden.
Who do you think are Republicans in the Senate that are most likely to cooperate with a Biden administration?
I mean, you look at the you look at like the DW nominate scores. So it's a measure of how frequently members vote with their own party versus voting with the other side. And, you know, you look 30 years ago, a scatter plot, and the dots are all overlapping and there's a lot of bipartisanship that's happening. And then you look over the last few Congresses and the clouds are just drifting further and further apart. So there's such little overlap right now between even the most moderate Republican, who's arguably Susan Collins, who was the key person in the early years of the Obama administration, voted for stimulus, you know, indicated for a long time she was going to vote for the ACA, even though she didn't. You know, she could be somebody that they try to lure over, but they're probably not going to need her. I mean, you know, if they have 50 votes, they're going to be playing team ball, and it's going to be people like Manchin and from West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona who are going to be the kind of outlier votes in the Democratic conference. But even they, I would expect, vote with the party, you know, 70 or 80% of the time.
Yeah, and we came out the gate, you know, real hot there on specific examples. And I appreciate that, Tori. That's where I wanted to go. But taking a step back, just for our listeners' benefit, we are discussing sort of the concept or potential reality of divided government versus unified government under all one party and how that might impact policymaking going forward. And John, you worked in the House, the White House, the Senate. Was it ever during a point where we had divided government? And what was that like?
Yeah, I worked when I was when I worked at the White House. It was when right after the Democrats took control of the House and Senate in 2006. And then when I worked for McConnell between 2010 and 2014, it was right before the Republicans took majority in the Senate. So, you know, in the lame duck White House of the Bush administration, there were still, you know, that was, you could still get deals done, right? There was a deal to increase the minimum wage. There was bipartisan cooperation on a consumer product safety bill that I worked on. I mean, you would get some accomplishments done, at least back then. And I think over the last 10 years, it's just become a lot harder. And Congress does fewer things. The things that it does do either pass with, you know, 100-0 or 51-0 in the Senate, or 51-49 in the Senate, where it's like super, super divided or easy, low-hanging, unanimous fruit. And that's a newish dynamic in Congress. And then, you know, during the Obama administration, when I worked for McConnell, the Republican Party was in a real mode of opposing everything Obama wanted to do. And, you know, we were the minority at the time. But in the Senate, because of the way it works, because of the filibuster, the minority has an unusual amount of control. The Republicans controlled the House, but the Senate minority was incredibly relevant when it came to cutting deals with the Obama administration. So we did deals on extending the Bush tax cuts, you know, keeping the government open, increasing the debt limit. These are kind of like basic bare bones, bare minimum stuff you have to do for the government. And that was all a struggle to get done because of the partisan opposition. And I think that's going to be the case in a Biden administration too, if Republicans continue to control the chamber.
In negotiations, it sounds like it's largely dependent upon who the leaders are that are doing the negotiating and whether they're willing to play ball more so than just the divided versus unified government dynamic.
There's truth to that, I think. I mean, the leaders, the reality is a leader in Congress is only as good as the kind of buy-in he can get from his members. So in some cases, you know, a leader will have a lot of leeway to, you know, in the case of the Bush tax cuts, extend 95% of them, but let the top 5% taxes go up or whatever ended up being. In other cases, you know, you gotta, like, the leaders are kind of looking over their shoulder to see what direction the members want to go, because ultimately they're the elected leader of a body of politicians, and they can't go too far astray from there. They can only take the herd so far before the herd kind of devours them or tramples over them, right? So it's not like the phrase McConnell used to use was that being leader in the Senate is like being an undertaker. Everyone's beneath you, but no one's listening. Trent Lott used to call it herding cats. I think that was the name of his book. And it's a difficult reality to navigate.
Well, Those are interesting graphics to think about. Coming up, and you got the debt limit. I am not a big fan of using the debt limit for leverage. I don't even like the debt limit at all. Seems strange coming from a fiscal hawk, I suppose, but it seems to be like consoles that have gone bad. I don't know if the debt limit does anything but potentially hurt. but it's there, and it's coming up. Do you see that as a maybe a hook or even an excuse for people to get together and do things that they might want to do, but they need some excuse to say they're going to come together and do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was certainly dynamic in the Obama administration, and that seems like a reasonable thing to assume about a Biden administration. You know, the Republicans are the ones, I expect the Democratic position is going to be in line with yours, which is, you know, the debt limit's an anachronism. It serves actually no function except to empower the people who are willing to go, you know, default on the debt to make concessions. And I just don't know where the Republicans come down on this. You know, the debt limit was raised pretty easily in the Trump administration, but the political dynamic under President Trump was so different because he kind of just made deficits a 40th tier issue relative to everything else, and no one cares about that right now. That's going to look a lot different next year when the Republicans are back in the opposition. Biden's got a big spending agenda, and one of the ways they're going to be able to oppose it is by saying, you know, we're against this runaway debt that's going to bury our children. So I just don't know how that pans out. You also have the opportunity that maybe you can deal with it if you did a COVID relief bill. Maybe you get something that extends it. You know, let's say they can't get something done in December and they do a CR that goes till March. Maybe in the March CR, they do a rider that extends it. And, you know, we just have to wait and see how that plays out. And if Republican members are willing to take that hostage again.
My initial reaction as to whether to do a big omnibus bill at the end of this year versus waiting until next year is to take some polling in the Georgia races and figure out whether or not the Democrats have any hope in hell of getting to a majority, you know, courtesy of the vice president elect in the Senate. But we know that polling data is not exactly the most reliable these days. So I'm wondering how they go about getting the information that they need to make the decision as to whether or not to pull the trigger, if you will, on an omnibus negotiation this year versus punting until next year.
Richard Shelby, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee today, put out a bunch of bills that he said were like consensus bipartisan Senate bills. And they look for, and there's 12 appropriations bills they have to do. And, you know, he's looking forward to working with the House and getting this done. And I just don't get a good sense of what the House is willing to do. That's a lot to negotiate in a month. Are these 12 appropriations bills funding, you know, $1.4 whatever trillion dollars in appropriations to the federal government in a kind of nasty partisan environment? They're going to have lame duck sessions are really hard to predict. Members are in weird moods. You know, you don't usually see significant legislation moving in lame duck sessions, especially ones where the president's lost his reelection. So I it's really hard to predict how the next month is going to go. You know, there's markers we can look at and signposts, but I just don't have a strong view here. You know, if the past predicts the future, they've been unable to agree on anything all year, ever since March when the CARES Act miraculously came together. So I'd be a little surprised to see a bipartisan kumbaya moment in a lame duck session, especially when you've got the incoming Democratic president who's going to reset the political stage.
Hey, Chase, before this is the rebellion of the co-host here, not letting you get in a word, but I have one final thing just to throw
have at it, Bob, have at it.
Well, I mean, aside from all the other complications that we've gone through, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments on whether the ACA is unconstitutional in the absence of a mandate. If the Supreme Court were to rule that the ACA is unconstitutional, that would throw another monkey wrench into everything, because presumably Congress would then need to plunge back into negotiations over a health care bill. And I wonder, John, what your thinking is on that, just in terms of whether they've even thought about it or how they would go about pursuing that.
I mean, I think the Supreme Court overturning this thing is everyone's worst nightmare, because now you've got a problem you have to solve. You've got people who are losing their health insurance. You've got industry that's going to be thrown into turmoil. And it's going to be the dominant issue until the issue for the next several months. I don't know. It's a Republican lawsuit, but I think the Republicans, it's a lawsuit being brought by Republican attorneys general. And I think that because of that, if they win, the Republican attitude is going to be great. We've accomplished our goal. Like, this is the thing we've been trying for 10 years. And I don't see how they cooperate to try to fix any problems that solves, even though it will create issues for health insurers and the end constituents. And the legal folks I've talked to and healthcare folks I've talked to tend to think that the case is pretty thin. And so it's unlikely to get overturned. And you could just say it's severable and it's not going to take down the whole law, which would probably be the best case scenario. I'd also be a little surprised if you really think the Supreme Court is as political as a being as some people think it is, that they would get involved here. Like, it's just such a radical move to overturn this law right now. Plus, with the fix is so easy, just bring back the mandate penalty. So that seems like a more likely kind of remedy they could recommend, but we'll see what happens.
Be careful what you wish for, as the saying goes.
And Bob, your rebellion fed right into where I wanted to go anyway. I've got a bit of a political strategy question for you, John, and it has to do with the concept of reform. It could be the ACA, it could be Social Security, it could be really anything. What do you think would be the most fruitful environment for which Biden could be have an effective first 100 days in terms of any long-term reform? And I ask that because, is it better for him to have a Republican-controlled Senate in terms of seeing maybe some cover from the far left of the Democratic Party in order to get more moderate or more bipartisan legislation? Or do you think unified government's the best way to go here?
For Biden, the Republican-controlled Senate is most helpful for his cabinet nominees, because now he can basically say, what choice do I have? I had to put, Meg Whitman at Commerce, or, I couldn't put, sorry, Bernie Sanders, I can't make you Labor Secretary. The Republicans blocked it, which would probably happen anyway. He needs an excuse for not putting Elizabeth Warren at Treasury. And now Mitch McConnell provides that excuse. That really helps Biden, I think, in his transition. It's going to make challenges. Like, I don't know how you get an EPA administrator, given the differences between the parties on these issues. I don't know how you get a Labor Secretary, but it does solve some problems for Biden, where I don't think it makes a big difference around entitlement reform. I mean, that was big. McConnell's big thing, I remember, during the Obama administration was, look, everyone remembers McConnell saying, maybe not everyone, the media always repeats McConnell saying, our number one political goal is making Obama one-term president. But then they don't remember him saying right after that, we are gonna find areas, the American people put us here to be a check on liberal governance, but we're going to find areas where we can work together and we're going to accomplish those things. And the two areas he focused on then were trade and entitlement reform. And neither of those went very far in the Obama administration, because I think that, neither party, trade, the politics went sideways, after the global financial crisis, partially because of President Trump. And then on entitlement reform, neither party really wants to do this. It's not the Democrats did reform entitlements in the ACA. They cut a lot of funding out of Medicare and they lost their House majority over it. Nobody wants to cut Social Security. Nobody wants to raise the taxes to pay for it. So I think what you need is either a crisis or you need unified governments, probably under Democrats, who are gonna tackle these issues in the form of tax increases, not benefit shifts. And I just think that's the way that we get out of this.
Well, speaking of crisis, I've often wondered if it would take a crisis to elevate issues like the nation's debt and growing budget deficits to a platform worthy of actions. What do you think it would take to get legislators or even the White House to say, hey, perhaps we should start thinking about at least putting those two things on a more sustainable path?
I've been saying this for 10 years. You need to have members have to start losing their seats over debt and deficits. And until that happens, it's just not gonna move the needle. It has to be an existential risk for members of Congress, but that's not the things they lose their seat over. They lose their seat over immigration reform. They lose their seat over, not supporting President Trump enough. They lose their seat over, a lot of other different issues. They're not losing their seat over entitlements. And if they did lose their seats over entitlements, it's because they're cutting them. So I just don't see, and right now, there's no political urgency. The Republican, all the deficit hawks, I think we talked about this last time, all the deficit hawks in the Republican Party are tied up and thrown in the closet by President Trump. They'll start, they're going to rip the duct tape off and, break out of the closet next year when Trump's gone. So you'll hear them again. But it's not, it's just not a, it's, it, there's no political urgency right now behind reforming entitlements, and there's no economic urgency because interest rates are still so low. So until you get to a crisis moment where you actually really can't afford this anymore, which we're nowhere near, doesn't look like, it's just not an issue.
I'm just real curious to what that crisis moment looks like. I mean, as long as the Federal Reserve is through machinations, if you will, buying treasury debt, they're not directly buying, they're buying the secondary markets, you know, picking up the long-term debt that others are getting rid of so that the investors can buy the new short-term debt that Treasury is issuing to finance these huge deficits. You know, as long as the Federal Reserve is doing that, I'm wondering where the action forcing event is, the crisis that causes everybody to come together and work on entitlement reform and tax reform and all the things that we need to do in order to get our debt and deficits under control. I mean, you look at things like interest rates and exchange rates, and people are still willing to hold dollars and interest rates are still low because of what the Federal Reserve is doing. I'm like, you know, is the United States in a unique position in that, you know, we are one of the largest economies. We have what we hopefully is a very stable democracy. You know, we exchange power in a nonviolent way, peaceful transition, et cetera. We have a stable currency. We have a free, largely unfettered economy, you know, are all of these things that make us so uniquely special that we can just continue to run up debt and ad infinitum and not experience these crises that should be showing signs of happening.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I wish I knew. I just don't see anything. Like the last entitlement reform, right, was Social Security reform in 83. And right. That was when you were on the verge of cutting people's seniors' checks, right? So right. That was, and obviously you wait longer now and the problem's bigger and the remedy's got to be bigger and it's not a great, you're way better off fixing it now. But we've been saying that since 2005 when President Bush first tried this. So it's like, it's just not a reality right now that anyone cares about this or that there's any urgency around it. And I don't know what's going to change that until you see some people's benefits actually being threatened.
Yeah, I can go back further. 1998 was when the Clinton administration launched the year of Social Security reform. And
it is amazing those things are off the radar, right? Like that was such a big deal. When Clinton tried it, Bush tried it, Obama didn't go near it. And Trump I don't think he's uttered the word Social Security in the last 5 years. So it just shows you how it's fallen off the radar.
As the problem has gotten worse, the lack of the interest in fixing it has weakened, which is kind of strange.
It's an interesting paradox for sure. All right. So John, as we wrap up this segment, one question for you, it's sort of a generic one. How are you advising clients right now over the next 2 years ahead of a midterm election? You know, we're already thinking about the next political election cycle. Are you approaching it with caution, optimism? Are you basically bearish or bullish on where the economy is likely headed and what we might see in terms of public policy?
So we use at Eurasia Group these political trajectories, and they're designed to give a view on the contribution of policy and politics to kind of market stability over the 6 month period and over a 24 month period. And we were at positive over 6 months, meaning we expected a stimulus, and negative over 24 months because we expected new regulation and tax increases. And with the divided government, we moved both of those trajectories earlier this week to neutral. On anticipation of a more boring Washington. So I just think that, you know, you're going to get the likeliest scenario right now is gridlock, where you don't see a lot of volatility coming from hostage taking around the debt limit, but you also don't see big tax increases, and you're not going to get a big stimulus. So it's just neutral. And I think that a lot of you've had the last 12 years have been marked by a period of high tension, high partisan tension, radical shifts in policy. And now you're going to just get 2 years of kind of, I think, a pretty boring outlook, which is going to be good for markets for the most part, because, you know, and the first 6 months of next year could look great with the COVID vaccine coming back online in terms of economic growth. So, you know, that changes a little bit if the Georgia Senate seats flip, where you're going to get, you know, Biden will have a more aggressive agenda. But for now, I think that the outlook is divided government means low volatility.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, John Lieber, Bob Bixby, and Tory Gorman. We discuss the process and implications of policymaking in a potentially divided government. Thanks for joining the show, Bob, Tory, and John.
Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy, U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, Bob Bixby, and Tory Gorman. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director. Tory is Concord's policy director. Both are regular contributors on the show. Senator Cassidy has represented Louisiana in the U.S. Senate since 2014. Before being elected to the Senate, he was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2008. And prior to that, he was elected to the Louisiana State Senate in 2006. Senator Hassan has represented the great state of New Hampshire, no bias here living in New Hampshire myself, in the U.S. Senate since 2016. Prior to being elected, she was a two-term governor of the state and served three terms as a state senator. Both Senators Cassidy and Hassan serve on a variety of key committees and subcommittees, but one that stood out to me is the Fiscal Responsibility and Economic Growth Subcommittee, where both senators serve, and Senator Cassidy is the chair. Senator Hassan is the ranking member. Welcome to Facing the Future, Senators.
Thank you.
Happy to have you both here. We're going to be talking today about a bipartisan COVID-19 relief proposal that you helped put together. And I think I'll start out with just a real general question for the benefit of our listeners. What are the core features of this bipartisan, bicameral compromise that you've helped put together?
Probably the biggest chunk of money is going to support these small businesses that have really had a hard time. There'll be a second tranche of the payroll protection plan. Now, I emphasize both the payroll protection and the small business aspect of it, because we know the vaccine's being rolled out. If some of these businesses can just continue a little bit longer, they will get through this rough patch. Now, to qualify, they have to see their revenue fall by at least 30%. I think I have that number correct. Okay. And we are, of course, encouraging them to continue to keep people employed. So it's not just to keep the business, but it's to keep people employed. And that's the biggest chunk of dollars. For those who are unemployed, there will be support with enhanced federal unemployment benefits for that stretch. There's money for vaccinations, there's money for testing, there's money for education. How do we keep schools open, keep them safe, and help them adapt to the COVID response? Maggie, I'll turn it back over to you. I know there's others, but I'll stop there.
Well, and first of all, thanks for having us on. And yeah, we've been hearing from our constituents. I've certainly been hearing from Granite Staters. I know Bill's been hearing from his constituents in Louisiana about the dire straits people and businesses are in as we are facing a pandemic and an economic crisis that have created a situation the likes of which I haven't seen in my lifetime. And I think that's true for almost all Americans right now, a joint public health crisis and economic crisis. This COVID relief package is designed to be really an interim measure to deal with the exigencies on the ground right now, and recognizing that a new administration is coming into office and will have its own plans and its own strategy for helping us get through the pandemic and then rebuild the economy. And so the package that we have come to agreement on, as Bill said, has a continuation of the payroll paycheck protection program. It also addresses the public health challenges we're facing, everything from not only money for vaccine distribution, but additional resources for our healthcare providers. Very important to me in particular is a set aside within that money for our nursing homes, because they have been so particularly hard hit. Public schools will get a significant amount of additional money. I think there's $54 billion in the package for K through 12 public schools, another $20 billion in the package for higher education, not only for institutions of higher education, but for the most financially challenged students that they serve. And then there's also additional funds for a flexible governor's fund to help with education. So those are some of the areas of agreement. It really is about hospitals, schools, businesses, and then to Bill's point, the unemployment portion of this is critically important because some people are facing the expiration of their benefits literally the day after Christmas.
I'll mention one more thing, and thank you, Maggie. By the way, I kept on calling it payroll, and I suddenly understand that it's paycheck, so thanks for...
I do the same thing. I go back and forth, so...
There's also rental assistance, mm-hmm. and what we've heard is that with the CDC saying that folks could not be evicted, there's a lot of small landlords that's really done a number on. They have to pay the utilities and the upkeep, and yet they've not received rental income. So we continue to have rental assistance, but it will go to the landlord so that if somebody stays in the apartment and they cannot otherwise pay for it, then the landlord is held harmless. Trying to, you know, you just got a lot of parts of our economy that have been affected by this. You take care of one, you have to make sure you take care of the first and second degree aspects of that. And so I'm glad for those landlords. And
yeah, no, so it's, there's a combination of making sure landlords get paid and tenants don't get evicted, and that's a delicate balance. There's also childcare dollars and nutrition assistance. So one of the things we've really focused on is what kind of financial challenges are the people most impacted by the pandemic facing, and how can we get individual assistance to people in need. So there are, you know, if you really break down the agreed upon $748 billion, there are a lot of items like that. It was very important to this group as a bipartisan group to focus on this being a relief package and less of what others might think of as an overall stimulus package. Although obviously the unemployment benefits, for instance, and the rental payments have a stimulus effect.
Well, I think that this is a fascinating exercise that you folks have gone through. And it's, I really enjoy watching your press conferences, because I look at this and I say, this really is the way things are supposed to work, with people coming together from different perspectives and finding some sort of consensus for the common good. And I'm wondering, with the Senate being as closely divided as it is, and it will be no matter how the runoffs go, is this perhaps a model? I mean, how did this come together? And is this perhaps a model that might have implications for solving future problems?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, one of the things that I worked on as governor, coming from a state that is very purple, and in one of my terms, I had a split legislature. In another one of my terms, I was the Democratic governor, and my legislature, both chambers, were controlled by Republicans. You do have to listen to your constituents about what's important to them and then find a way forward. And, you know, this group of senators is a group with long relationships. I think you heard them talk yesterday. Some of them were actually in town in DC over Thanksgiving. And so they got physically together with COVID precautions in place, of course. Others of us, like Bill and I, have been working on a number of bipartisan things, including trying to finally get a solution to this issue called surprise medical bills. So as you work on a number of things together, and the subcommittee you've mentioned that we both lead, you begin to develop a language with each other about how you might find a common approach to solving a challenge that you both agree is out there and your constituents all agree is out there. And so that's really how this came about. A group of people have known each other for a long time. A group of people have been working on various elements of COVID relief or other issues together, and worked hard to come together to find our way forward. And as you heard us talk about yesterday, there's general agreement that we also need to do state and local aid, and that some sort of liability protections for business owners who are acting in good faith during COVID is appropriate. But those issues are going to take us a little longer, and we'll continue to work on those. But I hope this becomes the kind of relationship builder that keeps us all talking and working together.
The one thing I would add to that is that we had two members of the House Problem Solvers Committee. Yeah. And so 25 Republicans, 25 Democrats, and they really are a balance of power over there. So there can be a fringe group that's going to object, but there's enough folks from the other party that can help something get over. And knowing that we're kind of getting intel, okay, what do we need to do on the House side to make sure this happens? But by the way, if we follow this intel, then it will pass the House, I think really was a wind in the sail of our effort.
Yeah,
that I think was very valuable. And since the House is going to be very closely divided, the degree that we have this kind of relationship on both sides, I think will make our efforts more likely to succeed.
Well said. You know, I try to remind people that our constituents solve problems all the time without regard to political or philosophical differences. And, you know, we do it in business, we do it in our families, in our communities. And so bottom line should be, we should find a way to do that here too.
So Senators, my question is to you. I'm a former Capitol Hill staffer and a student of the Senate. I've always been fascinated at the way things, legislation comes together. This was a very unique process. Not only did it exist outside of leadership, it also existed outside of the committee process. And it also included bicameral negotiations all in one fell swoop. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before. And I'm just wondering, as participants in this group, what was sort of your takeaway? What did you have any aha moments, any takeaways from this experience this surprised you and something that'll stay with you as you move forward in the 117th Congress?
You know, I think one thing I've learned here is that you can actually go outside the committee process. You can go outside the committee process if it's a big enough issue and if the committees are not making progress. If it's a small issue that people aren't paying attention to, it'll just be a tree falling in the forest and no one else is around. But something like this, where clearly Congress was not functioning, but the need was huge, is where folks on a kind of an organic level can come together and can make a difference. And so and I say that because Maggie and I have been working together on surprise medical billing, which has been initially outside the committee process. It entered into the committee process, but it also had a bicameral function to it. And it was kind of this organic floating up first, initially taking on the issue, then floating up through the committees, but continuing to influence the committees just because we've done so much great work. So Tori, to your point, it's unique, but I do think there's a unique set of issues that are high profile enough that just rank and file can make it work and influence the committees if the committees are not taking it up. But if they do take it up, continue to influence the committees.
Mm-hmm. I also think to Bill's point, a couple of things on surprise medical bills. While we are not in leadership, we are both on help committee and finance committee, which is our critical areas of jurisdiction. So you can ask for support and help from your leadership, who often will say, well, this hasn't been a leadership priority, but we see why it's important. Go to it. In this bipartisan COVID relief process, I think a couple of things. One is, the need covers so many different areas of jurisdiction in terms of legislative committee talk that no one group was going to own the overall product. The other thing I learned, and I thought it was an important point, I think it was Senator Manchin made it yesterday, we actually decided as a group that we needed to get legislative text done. So we started with that framework that everybody saw. And then God bless our staffs who have been working almost around the clock. I think one of my staff members said she was gonna stop working before midnight last night for the first time in like 10 days. We really said to them, get to the committees with the expertise, get to the committee staff and start really working on the drafting. And the fact that we did that now means that leadership may decide to follow this entire framework. It may decide not to. We've got, the White House has to be part of these negotiations too. But the language is done, and that means it's been vetted with committees too, and our colleagues who are leadership on those committees. And that means that while we have kind of driven the mechanics here and the agreements, by reaching out to our colleagues, a lot of the Senate has actually weighed in at some point on this. And I think that's important for buy-in and for progress.
That's absolutely critical, having the committees buy-in. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
I apologize. My staff has scheduled me, Chase, for another call right now. So I'll have to sign off. But
your excuse.
If we need to reschedule to flesh this out more, I'll make myself available.
Well, Senator, we'd be happy to have you back on, obviously, but certainly jump off here so you can get to that call. We appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you all.
And in the spirit of bipartisanship, we probably should wind this up.
That's a great point. So how about this? Yeah. If we have time, as we see the future of this legislation develop, we can have you both back on for a more in-depth conversation.
Well, I'd love to do that.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy, U.S. Senator Maggie Hassan, Bob Bixby, and Tori Gorman discuss bipartisan COVID-19 relief legislation that the senators have helped co-author. Thank you for joining the show, Senator Hassan, and Senator Cassidy, who already had to jump off here because of another commitment.
Thank you guys so much. Take care and be safe.
Thank you, Senator. You too.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.